kind of the key verse that we have chosen for our study. Those of you that are here perhaps for the first time in several weeks, we are not spending a great deal of time in the scriptures. Now, I want to preface all that by saying that's not because we don't emphasize the importance of the scriptures. We do, but we're in a class here that involves the teaching of American history. I don't know that any of you are here for the first time this morning, but if perchance you are, there are some biblical foundations to our country that have been all but eradicated by whoever, and we spend hours on who, trying to determine who's doing it, but they have been removed, and Americans, for the first time in probably their history, are not learning their history. And so we decided to go back and look at the biblical foundations of our history and try to lay those things on the line. Psalm 33:12 said, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people whom he hath chosen for his own inheritance." And as we begin, let me just preface a little bit this morning by saying there's something strangely unique about this nation. And you'll hear much said on the media about why this part of the world became so affluent. I hear, you know, commentators say from time to time it was because of the abundance of resources in the New World. But the truth of the matter is the New World is not unique as a total. You take the countries of Mexico, you take the countries of Bolivia, Brazil, Ecuador, Venezuela, you go to South America, you take all the countries of the Mexican Peninsula, you go to Canada. None of those nations are any different from the European poverty you find in Europe. It is only one nation that is different. And if one nation is different, you cannot ascribe it just to the natural resources. Because South America has as much resources, Canada has more resources than the United States has. Why is it that this little cluster of states here on the mainland of North America became the paramount nation in the history of all the world in this eon of time that we know about? And that's what we're trying to discover. Now, several weeks ago, we began, and if I get a couple fellas here, I don't know if I've got enough of these or not, but I've got about maybe just one to a family, and then if we got any extra, you can pass the rest of them out. These are just maps, all right? I don't want to... Some people had asked me, if they could obtain a map so they could get an idea of what we were talking about again. And so I just ran these off. If you want to sketch in what we're going to show you this morning, you will be much enlightened. As I said last week, and not to, again, antagonize anybody, but much of the history books leave out what's going on in Europe at the same time America is being explored, and it is that of the rise of the papacy to its height and to its really the most prominent position of power that it had held in all of its history. And we talked about the fact that when Columbus discovers America, Martin Luther is 10 years of age. The Reformation will not begin, as far as Luther is concerned, until 1519, about 27 years beyond when Columbus discovers America. So if you want to find out what's going on in Europe and the position, the political background that these explorers are coming from, you have to study English history or European history. And you'll find most textbooks completely obscure what's going on in Europe at this time, because it is indeed an embarrassment to primarily the papacy. And we talked about it last week. There are literally millions and millions of people being executed all over Europe at this period of time. There are dissidents in the Catholic Church. We talked about the Catharai. The Catharai is an order of priests. You don't hear much about it because they were eliminated. They were obliterated. The Catharai were dissidents. They settled in northern Italy. They were friendly with a group by the name of called the Waldensians, who up in the northern area of Italy there. Trying to think of what they call that, Tyrol, up in Tyrol. We were there a couple years ago up in the Alps, and the Waldensians hid out up in the Alps trying to escape the persecution that was on them. Suffice it to say this, the papacy by the late 1400s had its design on the control of Europe. And if you, again, study history, you'll find that to be so. Several of the English kings had balked at the papacy's power because of the Hundred Years' War between Spain or between France and England. And the papacy seemed to be siding with the French a little more. And so the English balked. And when that happened, the papacy put out what was called Unum Sanctum, which is Boniface's papal bull that stated that there is no salvation outside of the Catholic Church. And that if you did not believe in the supremacy of the Pope, then you are condemned to hell forever. And that's basically what that papal bull said. Now, he issued that trying to get the King of England to knuckle under. He wanted his power reestablished there, and it backfired on him because Philip the Fair, who was the king of France, when he read that, he wasn't about to have anything to do with that. He wasn't going to buy into that either, so he had Boniface put in prison, and Boniface died in prison. And we went through last week the 70-year exile of the Roman Catholic papacy, how that it was existed at Avignon, France. Brother Kidd has been to the Palace of the Popes there in Avignon, France, where the papacy actually existed. It was not in the Vatican, was not in Rome for 70 years period of time, and they ruled from there. We're not going to go through all that, but I just wanted to bring you up to date as to what is going on. When Columbus set sail for America, when Coronado, when De Soto, when Cortez, when Torzaro, and some of these men we're going to look at, when they came to America from that background. And the papacy's rule of thumb had been this: if you can't control them, kill them. Now, I don't mean to sound cruel and unkind, but the facts of history will back me up on that totally. That's the philosophy that they have, and that's why people were dying in Europe. You say, why is that important? Because you're going to see that's exactly the philosophy that was brought to the New World. And we have, as we come across here, we talked a little bit last week about Columbus and the Spanish influence. And of course, the Spanish influence comes down into the southern part of what we call North America there. Columbus lands in 1492 on the island of San Salvador. He explores several of the Caribbean islands during the next 8 or 9 years. He makes 4 voyages to the New World. He establishes a colony at Santo Domingo called La Navidad, and one of his ships sinks while he's there in the harbor. He has to leave 39 of the crew because the Pinta and her captain had journeyed off in search of gold, so they only had 2 ships left. One of them sank in the harbor. He had to leave 39 men there to establish a colony. And so 39 men are left on the island there of Santo Domingo, and they establish a colony in that area. He leaves, Columbus does, and heads back to England. There are 300,000 Indians in population on that island when Columbus leaves to return to England. 16 years later, there are 20,000 of those Indians left. You say, why? If you can't control them, you kill them. And when the colony was established, word first of all came that if you want to know what the Spanish were interested in, they were interested in gold. You read the history of the Spanish conquistadors and the Spanish explorers, they're all looking for gold. They want wealth. You say, why? Because in 1519, when Martin Luther gets stirred up, and because of the problems in the papacy, they're about to launch what's called a counter-reformation. And you hear a lot about the Reformation under Martin Luther. You never read about the counter-reformation. I've been in the cities of Frohnleiten, Austria. I've been in the city of, trying to think of the name of, Rotenburg, Germany. Just two cities that I've been in personally where in the Counter-Reformation, the armies under the control of the Roman Catholic Pope killed every Protestant man, woman, boy, and girl, child, killed every one of them in the cities. I've been in both those cities. That's the Counter-Reformation. They needed money to fund that. And they're looking for gold. They're searching for gold. Columbus comes, and when he lands, some of the Indians have little gold earrings and jewels. Not an abundance of gold. It's not there. But Columbus's inquisitiveness gets the best of him. He asks about the gold, and they tell him, well, it's on this island. The Indians had a desire to please the white man. And you're going to learn some things. As a matter of fact, when we get on over here to where Montezuma and the Aztec Indians are located, you're going to find out that the Aztecs for years had believed that someone from God was going to come as a messenger to their people, and their own tradition told them that he was white-skinned, and they had never seen a white man in their life. But their own religious tradition told them that a white-skinned individual was going to come and tell them of the true God as a messenger from the true God. So the Indians had a desire to please the white man. Obviously, the white man possessed things the Indians didn't have. He was still kind of elementary in the use of guns, but he had gunpowder. He had guns. He had techniques to build. He had techniques to farm that, although by our standards they were primitive, by the Indians' standards they were miles ahead of where the Indians were. And the Indians had a desire to please. So really, they told Columbus, well, there's gold on this island. And they'd go to an island, wasn't any gold there. And they said, well, it's gold on this island. And they weren't trying to run him around as much as they were just trying to please him. They knew that gold pleased him, so they kept telling him there's gold somewhere. And Columbus ended up on his voyage on the island of Cuba, which is here. We mentioned last week that Columbus in his diary records that as he left the island that they had named Cuba, and again, understand, Columbus never knew that he discovered a new world. He died not knowing that. He thought he was in the Indies. He thought he had literally sailed all the way around the world and had landed in the Indies, and he was concerned about finding the mainland of China, where Marco Polo and those before him had explored. So Columbus set sail from this island that the Indians had called Cuba on a course of north, intending to go to the mainland of what he thought would be China. And in his diary, he records that he no more than cleared the island before the headwinds or the winds changed and became headwinds and literally drove him off his course to the north. He could not proceed to the north and had to turn and head back out into the Caribbean. You say, why is that important? Because I firmly believe that God would not allow the Papist Spanish method of operation to come to this country at that point in time. God kept them out. You say, why? The philosophy was, if you can't control, kill. Now you say, well, I just don't believe that. Well, you go down here, look at the history of this large body of land down here called South America, you find an America down there for me. You come in through here, Columbus was in Costa Rica, he was in Honduras, he was along the coastline there of El Salvador. As a matter of fact, Columbus, when he went to Costa Rica, finally found some gold. On one of his last voyages, he found a pretty good quantity of gold, and Columbus wrote back, said that he had discovered Solomon's mines from King Solomon. He found out where Solomon got his gold, and he became so possessed by gold that two of his ships actually were worm-eaten and had to be discarded. They nearly starved to death before he got back to England, and Columbus dies in dishonor. Now, I'm going to say this because I don't want to discredit Columbus. Columbus may have been a saved man. From some of the things that he wrote, he was not a good papist. I know that. He was not a blind follower of the papacy. He was a dissident. And yet when he came to this country, he had to have somebody to finance his expedition. And that became the King and Queen of Spain, Ferdinand and Isabella. And so he set sail for them. And when he said he was coming to this country and he talked about his love for God, the God that he loved was not the same God, or at least was not represented by the same religion that Ferdinand and Isabella was, because they were devout papists to the day of their death. Their country had ended the conquest of the Moors with one of the last crusades. They had kicked the Moors out of Spain. Columbus comes, and that's basically where we'd gotten to last week. Columbus made four voyages, settled La Navidad. I talked about 300,000 Indians on those islands, and within 2 years, 100,000 of those Indians had been killed. 14 years later, of all those 300,000 Indians, only 20,000 of them remained. So the idea of what's going on, you can get an idea of what the, how they resulted in what's happened with the Indians. 1500, a fellow by the name of Pedro Cabril from Portugal landed in Brazil. Portugal, at the same time Spain became a great exploring nation, Portugal had been a great nation as well. Portugal, however, had chosen to find a route to the Indies by going south around the African Horn and on to the Indies, and they had put all their money into discovering that route, mapping that route out. So Columbus actually appealed to King Henry VII of England and asked for money, and Henry turned him down. He also had appealed to the King of Portugal for financing of his expedition, and he was turned down there. It was only then that he went to Ferdinand and Isabel in Spain. But what had happened is, after the Spanish discovery here, the Portuguese actually were better explorers than the Spanish were. The Portuguese had a jump on them because they'd already been around the Horn of South Africa, and they knew where they were going basically, so they set sail over here, and a great feud erupted as to who gets what. And so the line of demarcation was drawn up by the Catholic Church, and they said that Spain can have everything on one side and Portugal can have everything on the other side, which basically goes to show you who thought they were controlling the New World. It wasn't Spain, and it wasn't Portugal. It was the papacy that drew up the line and said, well, you can control this, and you can control that. Well, who actually controls it then? So the Portuguese came. They began to settle a bit in South America, although they're limited as to how far they can go because of this line of demarcation that was established. In 1513, Ponce de Leon makes the first Spanish landing on the American continent. Ponce de Leon actually had been exploring down in the islands. He had been on the island of Puerto Rico, and while he was there, the Indians had told him that there was a fountain that if you tasted of it, it would make you young forever. And you say, what were they doing? Well, I don't know if they were still trying to please the white man or just get rid of him. I'm not sure at that time. Anyway, Ponce de Leon sails north, and he makes landfall in Florida. Now, that's 1513. 1492. 1513, you know, less than 25 years later, they are beginning to move into America. But they can't make a settlement. Ponce de Leon runs into two things that he hadn't planned on. One's called the mosquito. And the mosquito eats up basically most of the crew that he's got, nearly kills all of them. And another one is called the Seminoles. Now, that's not the football team. Now, that's the Indians that had lived in that part of the country, and they heard the white man was coming, and they were ready for him. And they were not about to let the Spanish settle in that part of the world. And they literally kept the Spanish influence, I mean, at bay. They literally had them surrounded. They couldn't do much of anything there as far as establishing a colony was concerned. In 1513, the same year, Balboa sails for Spain, and Balboa comes here to the Isthmus of Panama and fights his way across that thing. Takes him a year or better. And when he gets across that thing, he was sure that he was going to find the Indians. They still believed they were right at him. And it was one of the most discouraging discoveries that was ever made. Because when he plowed his way through and came out on the other side over here, he found an ocean that was even bigger than the one they had just crossed. He was awfully discouraged, and so was Spain, Portugal, and even England, because they were sure the world was not quite that big, and that they were right at the point of discovering a passage to the Indies, only to find the Pacific Ocean stood in their way. So Ponce de Leon establishes no colony. Balboa crosses the Isthmus of Panama about the same time, and realize this again is still before the Reformation. And you're dealing with all of the turmoil in Europe that preceded the Reformation. There are hundreds and hundreds of people who just want to get out of Europe. There are dissident clergy and dissident priests that just want to get out of England or out of Spain and Europe. And so it's not hard to get a crew to come to the New World at this point in time. A lot of people just want to leave. Spain begins to make its roads down in here into this area. In 1519, 6 years after Balboa crossed Panama, 1519, Magellan, who was Portuguese but was sailing for Spain, see, the feud was going on. Magellan sets out on what is to be the first around-the-world voyage, and Magellan heads out, and instead of coming to the islands, he heads south around the tip of the Straits of Magellan, at the southern tip of South America, rounds the corner, and heads out, and finally ends up in the Philippine Islands. He never completes the voyage. He's given credit for being the first explorer to go around the world, but he actually dies in the Philippines. And he doesn't make it all the way around, but it is his name that stands out with those that first sailed around the world. Now, that was in 1519, the same year that the Reformation started. Also in 1519, Hernando Cortez came to America on a Spanish expedition, and he cuts across the Mexican mainland there, and finds for the first time the city of Montezuma. Some of you were Marines, and you sang the Marines hymn, you never knew where the halls of Montezuma were. That's where they are, Mexico City. Montezuma is the king or the ruler of the Aztec people. The Aztec Indians and the Inca Indians have for years been a blight on Europeans. We just went through the, what was it? I can't remember what number it was, but the celebration of Columbus's discovery of America in 1492. We just went through 92, and almost all of the things that were written were negative. And if you read any of it, you know how mean the white man was because he came and how he destroyed the Indian. But I want you to know that was one philosophy that came out of Europe. It was not the white man in general. That was the philosophy of the papacy. They never said that, but that's where the philosophy came from. And when Columbus came to this nation, when the explorers came to this nation, that's the philosophy they brought with them. They found two of the most advanced groups of Indians that ever existed, as far as we know. One called the Aztecs, the other called the Incas. And Cortez makes his way to Montezuma. Montezuma is the king of the Aztecs, and literally goes in there, befriends them, takes advantage of their friendship to gain great, great quantities of gold, and then begins what later would become known as genocide, the extermination of an entire race of people. And as far as we know, there is not one full-blooded Aztec remaining in the world today. They were all executed. Why? Because they were a proud people of Indians, and they would not be controlled by a Spaniard. And if you can't control, you kill. They were executed. Several years later, in 1531, Francisco Pizarro, crosses here, journeys on down to Peru, and in Peru he finds the second most advanced nation of Indians that were ever discovered, and they're called the Incas. And when he sets up with the Incas, he operates in much the same procedure that Cortez did. He captures the Inca chief or president or ruler, whatever you want to call him. His name is Atahualpa. And he captures that fella, and he tells the Indians, he said, I'm going to hold him, but you can ransom him. And you can ransom him by bringing me. And he mapped off a room, and he said, I want this room filled with gold to the ceiling. And it took them less than 48 hours. These people were wealthy. Remember, the Spaniards were after gold. When he realized there was that much gold to be had, he took the king out in the presence of all the people and garroted him, strangled him in the presence of all his people, and thinking that his people then would submit and become subservient to the Spanish rule. When they refused to do so, the Incas are destroyed. Now, there are some people running around who are descendants through other channels of some of the Inca people, but no such thing as an Inca civilization remains to this day. There are tribes of Indians that still remain in America. And there were a number of Indians killed in America, but never to the extent of the Aztecs and the Incas under the Spaniards. 1531, Pizarro attacked and killed the Incas. In 1539, and again, see, we're dealing in a very short period of time, less than 50 years. 1539, De Soto comes to America, Hernando de Soto. And De Soto comes to Florida, which has a struggling little colony, but they just can't seem to go anywhere. De Soto launches out from Florida and heads west, and he's the first man, as far as we know, to lay eyes on the Mississippi River. He extends the exploration over to that area and claims, of course, the Mississippi River. Nobody, for some reason, can get to the coastline of this country. The coastline remains basically untouched. Now, there are people exploring it. We're going to look at some of the English explorers that have been up there. Nobody can do anything up through there. You say, why is that important? Well, I don't even need to mention it. You're going to see how important the east coast of the United States becomes in immigration and settling and industry and commerce in a little while. But God will not allow that philosophy that says if you can't control, kill, to inhabit this country right here. Why? God's got his hand on this for a reason. And I think as Christian people, when we're all said and done, you're going to realize that God did here in this country what he never did any place else in the world. And the sad part about that is that you and I are fixing to let it die. That's the saddest part, is we're fixing to let it die. The Spanish explorers, basically, when the little area outlined in red here shows you the amount of land that Spain literally controls. Now, we talked about 1531, 1539, and 1540. Francisco Coronado heads north out of Mexico. And he heads north out of Mexico, and he has with him a great number of dissident Catholic priests. Remember, the Reformation's going on. And the best thing to do if you're a dissident is to get out of Europe if you can. And so he has some dissident priests with him. And basically, I'm going to say this. You've got two classes of men. You've got men that are hungry for gold and some of them that are upset with Europe. And they begin to come up through here and they begin to establish little missions along the way. Some of those little padres. You say, well, who were they? They were dissident Catholic priests. Unhappy with what was going on in Europe. And I'm going to be honest with you, some of those men probably led native Indians to Christ more than you and I ever will know about until we get to heaven. We talked about, you say, well, there's a difference in philosophy between the Catholic Church. I know that, but you read the writings of Savonarola, you'll find Savonarola believed you want to get to heaven, you had to repent of your sins and trust Christ as your Savior. The doctrine of the Catholic Church and its great vast difference from what we believe today came about right around the time of the Reformation, because Martin Luther nailed their carcasses to a door, and they had to take some militant stands to get rid of Martin Luther. But this is the conquest of the Spanish explorers. Notice they're all the way over into California. Now that's by the year 1540. Just to give you a little idea of some of the other things that are going on, in 1497, we're going way back again now, just because we're going to deal with another nationality. In 1497, just 5 years after Columbus had discovered the islands here, John Cabot had come to Newfoundland. John Cabot was an Englishman. And based on, actually, John Cabot was the first white man to set foot in America proper, as far as we know, at least the first explorer from the European continent. Cabot was an Englishman. So he did give England a little bit of right to make some claims in this new world, although England, by virtue of Columbus and the Portuguese, literally didn't have any choice at all. They weren't allowed to claim any land because the papacy said they couldn't have any. But Cabot had been here, and Cabot had explored the area of Newfoundland. That's why it was called Newfoundland. They weren't nearly as complex as we are. You know, they went to school and they didn't learn big words. What they said, they meant. And so they asked him where he'd been. He said, I've been to Newfoundland. And it was called Newfoundland, and that's what it's called today. Also, in 1534, the French had gotten into the activity. Now, what you had with some of these Spaniards, you had some Dominican priests, and the Dominicans were, they were not as reactionary as the Catheri were. The Catheri, honestly, could almost be classified as Bible believers. Now, I've got some of the writings of the Catheri, and they were pretty rough. The Dominicans were maybe just a little more liberal than the Catheri, but nonetheless, they were upset with what was going on in Europe. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Martin Luther was a Dominican. And the Dominicans came with the Spanish in through here. But what happened in Europe was there needed to be a loyal, strong order of priests. And that order was founded by Ignatius Loyola. And they were called the Jesuits. The Jesuits were termed as the papal army. They were the strong arm of the papacy for years. And when the French began to explore this country, they brought the Jesuits with them. In 1534, Jacques Cartier had sailed up the St. Lawrence River, down the St. Lawrence River, and had established a colony at Montreal in France. Several years later, 1608, Samuel de Champlain established a colony in Quebec in Canada. But for some reason, they couldn't push south. They ran into a nation of Indians called the Iroquois. And you see all the Wild West shows, folks. I'm just going to tell you, you've been greatly influenced by television. And don't ever talk to a Texan, because you're going to get a whole picture of American history that really is not quite accurate. You want to know where the Wild West was? You're living in it, basically. There were more Indians and white wars in Toledo and Detroit than they ever saw on the plains of the West. You talk about some wars going on. They took place right here. You've got the nations of the Iroquois up in New York. And they were not about to have white men enter their domain. And they held the French basically up here to this area around the St. Lawrence River and the Great Lakes. Years later, Marquette will come in northern Michigan, just about 5 hours from here. And Marquette will establish a mission there at Sault Ste. Marie and all of that area there, settled by, Marquette was a Jesuit. And the Jesuits' intention was to stop the spread of Protestantism. That's what their goal was, to stop the spread of Protestantism. So you've got dissident Catholics here, you've got Jesuits up here. If those guys had ever gotten together, it would have been Hail Columbia. But there was a buffer in between them that nobody could penetrate, and nobody could establish a colony. By 1580, less than 100 years after Columbus discovers America, King Philip II, who was now King of Spain, succeeded to the throne of Portugal. In other words, he ruled both countries. And when that took place in 1580, King Philip II basically ruled more of the known world than anybody that's ever lived. Because he not only got all that Spain had, But he got all that Portugal had discovered in Africa, around the Cape of Good Hope. It was all his. And when the Counter-Reformation was launched, he had promised his support to the papacy. And it was King Philip of Spain that instigated a lot of those mass executions. You have the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, where Huguenots, an entire town of Huguenots, are executed in one day. The whole city is killed, and the Roman Catholic Pope strikes a medal, gives to everybody participating, and gave them a medal that ensured them everlasting life in heaven because of their participation. That's how, again, I want to be guarded, because I don't want you to go out of here and hate. That's not what I'm trying to teach. But I am trying to teach something that hasn't been taught, unfairly so, to you. You need to know your heritage. And there is a great move to pull everything back together under one umbrella. And I think it's funny that the Jews say, we'll never forget what took place at Auschwitz. We'll never forget what took place at Treblinka, and rightfully so. But you Americans have forgotten where your heritage came from. And you need not to forget that. And there's King Philip dedicates all of his utilities to serving the Counter-Reformation. And he gets his eye on a place where they're having a little bit of trouble. And that's a place called England. English people have always been a little strange. I guess they are probably the height of arrogancy. And they don't like, because of their isolated position, they've always felt a little bit intimidated. Their existence was up there on a couple of islands just off the coast of the mainland of Europe. And they were intimidated because they did not have the large body of land. The weather in England has always been kind of rough. And what it is, I'm not sure, but they're a rough bunch of people. And that's going to be seen in the next few years of English history. They've been fighting. I mean, the English basically have been at war since about the 12th century with somebody. They just, you know, fought. They were a lot like the Germans. You know, the old German saying was, in case of rain, the war will be held in the auditorium. They just love to fight. And the English were like that. Now, I'm not trying to be very deep, but I want you to understand these things, and if you're taking notes, you can put these in your notes. There are basically three households that govern England. You have the House of Tudor, T-U-D-O-R, and there's several monarchs that rule from the House of Tudor, and following that comes the House of Stuart, and then following that comes the House of Hanover. When the American War for Independence is fought, it's fought against the monarch from the House of Hanover. But the other two are equally important. And as I said before, Columbus had appealed to King Henry the VII to gain some financing for his expedition. He failed to get it. Now, other than that, you probably would never know who King Henry the VII was. But you do remember who came after him. Who was King Henry the VIII? And King Henry the VIII was probably one of the greatest thorns in the side of the flesh of the papacy that existed. And the reason was, he just was an obstinate fellow. And remember the Unum Sanctum of Pope Boniface that had divided English loyalty because nobody could claim to rule England. And yet the papacy had done so. Well, Henry the VIII was kind of an amorous fellow. And he had the same problem that Solomon had, in that he wanted to take many wives. And the papacy withstood him on that. Now, I'm not trying to make him out to be a cream white, you know. He was a rogue boy. He was a terror. But Henry VIII decided he'd marry one. He didn't like her, and so he'd want to divorce her. Well, that was a no-no to the papacy. And so when King Henry VIII wanted to divorce his wife, they said no. So he came up with another idea, which was to execute them. We probably are fixing to find out that's much cheaper in modern-day America. But King Henry VIII decided, well, hey, if you want to let me divorce them, I'll bump them off. And so he begins to kill them, and of course the papacy objects to that, rightfully so. But when the papacy tries to exert their authority and control in England, that is the straw that breaks the camel's back. Because Henry VIII is not going to have the papacy rule in England. And so the Pope excommunicates Henry VIII, and Henry VIII in turn excommunicates the Pope. Henry VIII declares that as long as there's a church in England, I am the head of the church in England. Henry VIII never ended any Catholic doctrine. He never attacked any Catholic doctrine. Henry VIII basically was a Catholic, but I told you last week the issue was the papacy. And the greatest blow to Protestantism, I believe in freedom, believe what you want to believe. I honestly do. I believe the Catholic people, I have doctrinal disagreements with them, but I believe they have a right to believe what they want to believe. My main point of contention is the papacy. When a religion states that they have the right to rule the affairs of the world, they've kind of got my attention. And of course, supposedly they've all changed. Vatican I and Vatican II made that change, and of course, it's kind of unusual why now, for the first time in American history, we have an ambassador in the Vatican, if they're not political. I still am opposed to the papacy. You say, why? I just look at history. I just look at countries where they still are in control. I don't want that in America. Okay? Now, please, again, understand, I would never, somebody said, well, you just want to ship all the Catholics out of America. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. As a matter of fact, the first Catholics came to this country and settled in Maryland came out of England because they couldn't worship in England. They came here looking for religious freedom, and they found it. My opposition is to the papacy. Now then, in the House of Tudor, you've got King Henry VII. 1509, King Henry VIII comes. He causes all kinds of problems. Because for the first time in English history, there is a solid break between the Catholic Church and the Church of England. That's where the Church of England came, and it basically is the Catholic Church under the English monarchy. There were not a lot of changes. There are a number of dissidents during this time, several groups that come to the forefront. One of them is a group called the Puritans. The Puritans are a group of people who believe that they could purge the faults and the doctrinal errors of the Church of England from within. And they said, well, you know, there's some problems in the Church of England, there's some doctrinal problems that need to be straightened out, but we believe if we stay in here and fight the fight, we can straighten it. They were called Puritans. Then there was another group that said, nope, anybody that acknowledges any head of the church other than Jesus Christ is wrong. Be it the Pope, be it the King of England, there is no head of the church save Jesus Christ himself. And they're called the Separatists because they never linked up with anybody. They wouldn't join with anybody. King Henry VIII causes all kinds of problems. When Edward comes to the throne, Edward is kind of he's kind of a Gerald Ford type king. He was there, but you really know a lot about him. You think about, what did Gerald Ford do? Right? I mean, wasn't it bad? Certainly he wasn't indicted like the rest of them. Nobody ever said anything bad about him. He was a good man, as far as I know, good president. But what did he ever do? He didn't do a whole lot. And Edward is along that line. Now, Edward leans a little bit to trying to undo what his father had done. You see, Edward was he was his father's son. However, he was also his mother's son. And his mother still maintained very strong ties to the Catholic Church. So when Edward comes to the throne, he tries to, extend the right hand of fellowship and say, oops, come on back and let's forget this all happened. And but not a lot changes. It is not until 1553, that a woman rules England, and her name is Mary, Queen Mary. And she's called Mary, Queen of Scots. And by the time she's finished, her name is Bloody Mary. And she's called Bloody Mary because she begins the Counter-Reformation in England. And her goal is to eliminate every Protestant or every dissident in England and to restore the throne to the papacy. We've seen pictures here, the one picture in England where there's one small stone, and on that stone are inscribed the words, "Here in one day, 22,000 martyrs gave their lives." 22,000 people in one day. They're either burned at the stake, beheaded, whatever it could be. I mean, the tortures are diverse. But there is a desire to return the crown to the papacy, and through history, she'll be known as Bloody Mary. She probably killed more of her subjects, her own people, than any monarch that ever reigned on the face of the earth. And what happened was a strange thing. These Protestants and dissidents were an unusual group of people. And Rome was just going to school. They were just learning. But they were finding that the more they persecuted them, the faster they grew. And at the death of Mary, Queen of Scots, Queen Elizabeth comes to the throne in England, and she is the first English monarch to declare she is a Protestant. She is opposed to the Vatican, she is opposed to the papacy, and she establishes for the first time that the Church of England is not Catholic, but Protestant. Now that upsets some people in Europe. This is in 1558. Remember, by 1580, King Philip runs most of the world, and he's an ardent papist. He's looking for something to conquer, and so the English Isles loom before him. He has several advantages. Number one, he has the backing of the papacy. Number two, he has the backing of all the other countries in Europe over which he rules. Number three, he has the mightiest fleet and army in the known world. His conquistadors are the ones that went down here and conquered the Aztecs and the Incas. These are trained veteran troops. And Philip says, we're going to do something. Now, Queen Elizabeth, she has some ideas of her own. And although her fleet is really inferior, she has but a few ships. She says, you know, these Spaniards are bringing all this gold back. We could get some of it. And so you have, they're called pirates. You know, they became the bad guys. You know who the pirates were? They were English Protestants that plundered Spanish gold ships. Captain Kidd. You know, that's English. Bluebeard, I can't remember what his name was. They're English men, they're pirates. And they began to attack these Spanish ships and plunder them. And that further upsets the problem that we've got over in Spain with Philip. They began to plunder, and they began to take what they can get. And Queen Elizabeth, I think it was Drake that's fixing to sail around the world, was the first Englishman to go all the way around the world. And when he began to leave, she told him, she said, Sir Francis, I would sure like to be avenged of the Spanish. And so he sets out, and I don't know how many ships he sinks, but I mean, when he comes back to England, he has a ship loaded down with gold, compliments of the Spanish government. And he becomes known as a pirate. Brutal. Brutal. It's amazing, again, every time you read history, when Protestants are involved, you find about the brutality. When the papists are involved, there is no mention of brutality at all. You hear about the dirty, mean pirates, but you don't hear anything about the conquistadors that are raping women, burning villages, and killing Indians to get their gold. 1588, Philip decides now is the time. He collects 130 Spanish galleons, 30,000 conquistadors, and sets sail for the Netherlands, where he is going to take on more troops and invade England. And in 1588, before he ever got to the Netherlands, the English come shooting out of the English Channel, and in a surprise attack because of the fog, sank half of his fleet. The rest of them, deciding to regroup, turn tail and run, and when they do, they come into one of the worst maritime disasters that ever took place, one of the greatest storms that ever occurred, and sank over a quarter of the rest of the ships that were in existence. When it is all said and done, Philip said, "I sent my forces to fight with England, not with the winds of the Almighty God." And Philip recognized that God had defeated him. They never got to the Netherlands. They never picked up their troops. They never invaded English soil. And from that moment on, the Spanish Empire was done. She never regained prominence. And Queen Elizabeth became the focal point in European history, the Protestant queen. Queen Elizabeth reigned from 1558 until 1603. And she established the Protestant philosophy in England. So now you've got the Spanish in the south. You have the French in the north. And you have a Protestant nation in England. And so guess what's going to happen? The English are going to come to America. Now, I don't want to be one-sided, because the first Englishmen that came over here were gold-hungry thugs. I mean, they'd been taking gold off Spanish ships. They'd been seeing the French return. The French never got much gold. I'll tell you what they got. They got fur trade. They had been seeing the wealth being pumped out of the New World. And so the English aristocrats founded what's called the Virginia Company. Now in 1585, let me go through this first because it needs to be said, it's part of American history. In 1585, Sir Walter Raleigh had left England. This was before the defeat of the Spanish Armada. 1585, he had come to a little place called Roanoke, North Carolina. And he had established a colony at Roanoke, with the idea of making an English establishment. If you read the writings, you'll find that they told tales of the Indians carrying pots of gold that contained emeralds and diamonds. So I'll tell you why people were coming to the New World. They really weren't concerned about the Indians other than getting what they had. They established a colony there at Roanoke. It became known as the Lost Colony of Roanoke. John White was placed in charge of that colony as governor, and in just a few months' time, the people were on the verge of starvation. And so it was decided that White would return to England and equip another rescue party that would come back with provisions to take care of these people. And White left. And when he left his daughter and he left his granddaughter, who was the first person ever born on American soil. Her name was Virginia Dare. And that's, Virginia was named after Virginia Dare. He was never to see them again. Because when he returned to England, 1586, the Spanish were at war with the English, and that was the end of the defeat of the Spanish Armada. It was 2 years before he could return again to the colony. When he returned, they found no skeletons. They found nothing, not a trace of the English settlers. They ruled that there could not have been a massacre, for there would have been certainly skeletons left behind. They found nothing. They found carved into a tree four letters, C-R-O-A, which stands, I guess, for the Croatan Indians, and they assumed that maybe the settlers had gone there or the Indians had attacked. They never knew. They never found a trace of them. They were gone. That became known as the Lost Colony of Roanoke, and that was in 1585. 1588, Drake defeats the Spanish Armada. But in 1606, and I stress that because I want you to realize how many years there are between 1492 and 1606. There's 100 years plus that have elapsed, and God still has held this part wide open. See, what's interesting about that? This is going to become the mightiest nation that ever existed on the face of the earth. And 100 years after the New World is discovered, nobody lives there. The French can't come south. The Spaniards can't get north. It's hedged in. Time for us to quit. May the 14th, 1606. A group of individuals landed 40 miles up the James River. And they landed there at the colony that was to be known later on as Jamestown, named after King James of England. They established Jamestown, and of course, in their charter, in the Virginia Charter, like all documents, I guess, their little flower, and they said, we're going to go and take the gospel to the Indians, and, you know, it's our desire to convert them to Christianity. You not only want to read the documents, but you want to see what else they do with those documents. For instance, this group that came was 144 strong. And with 144 people, they brought one preacher with them. And in their own documents, the only reason they brought him was because they used these words, he could be controlled. They just wanted a preacher with them, but they wanted one that if they told him to shut up, he'd shut up. And so their great conquest to win the Indians to God started with 144 aristocrats or gentlemen and one preacher coming to this country. They brought no women with them. They brought no families. 144 men landed at Jamestown. From the first moment they got off the boat, they were in trouble. The Virginia Company had organized a charter and had set up a council to run the affairs of Jamestown. There was one man who was with them. His name was Bartholomew Gosnold. And Gosnold was an experienced explorer. In other words, he had been here before. He knew some of the hardships. And when they landed, I believe the place was called Cape Pleasant or something like that. And they liked it real well there. Gosnold told them, listen, this is low-lying land. It's subject to flooding. There is no fresh water here. We would be better to move inland and find the high ground and establish our colony there. They said, nothing doing. We like it just fine right here. It was May. It was beautiful. Springtime. Beautiful springtime there along. And they said, we're staying right here. The only problem was when summer came, they found they were in a swamp, and malaria began to set in, and they were in trouble. The other problem they had is one half of them were English aristocracy. They were gentlemen. You say, what problem was that? Well, what that means is an English gentleman does not do any manual labor. So from the day they got off the boat, half of them refused to work. They had come to this country, after all, to find the gold. And they got off the boat, and along with them was a fellow by the name of John Smith. You're going to know that name from Pocahontas and all that. We'll talk about all that later on. But some of these guys, out of that 144, 40 of them decided they want to go exploring. So before anything's built, they just, 40 of them just head for the bushes. They're going to find something. And they leave the other group there, half of them who won't work, to establish this colony. As I said before, they're in real trouble before they get started. By midsummer, they landed in May. By midsummer, there were only 5 men capable of doing any manual labor at all. The rest of them were sick to the point of death. The following winter, with only 2 weeks' supply of food left, John Smith, who brings the tale of American heroes, set out to trade with the Indians. If you read more of what John Smith did, he actually went out and executed Indians and stole their food. So much so that Powhatan, one of the Indian chiefs, captured him because he had killed 2 braves, and he was tried and sentenced to be executed, and Pocahontas came to his rescue, so they say. I mean, it sounds a little fishy. But Pocahontas came to his rescue, and for some reason, eventually, John Smith finds his way back into the Jamestown colony with that story, how Pocahontas had saved his life. I don't believe he ever went back to see Powhatan, however, after that, so I don't know if that's actually true or not. But Powell Hatton captures him and released him. I'll give you a little idea about what went on in Jamestown. It was 20 years before they ever planted their first crop in Jamestown. You say, where'd they get their food? They stole it from the Indians, or they brought it back from England. And it was a devastating existence of what went on there. In 1608, which is the second winter they were there, right in the middle of the winter, right in the dead of winter, a fire hit Jamestown and burned everything but three houses to the ground. And I'll read you some of the statistics here, but you see, more and more people were coming because England was still publishing, they were still publishing the flyers and the ads that said, boy, there's gold to be had and beautiful land. And the problem was every time a ship would arrive, it would arrive with sometimes 20 or 30 more inhabitants, and they would have less than a week's supply of food with them. And so again and again and again, the rations were cut in half at Jamestown. Let me tell you a little bit about the death toll. In the second year, okay, I told you after the first year, I'll give you that, 144 of them arrived, and after 1 year, 38 of them were left alive. The second year, others came, but in that year, 9 out of every 10 people that existed in Jamestown would die. That's a 90% death rate. They had no fresh water. They were infested with malaria. They had no food, and they wouldn't work. That sounds like modern America. 9 out of 10 would die. A few years later, I'll give you some of the other statistics and we'll press on next week then. But in 1619, 1,200 new inhabitants came to Jamestown, and that same year, 1,000 people died. In 1621, a total of 1,580 came, and in that same year, 1,183 died of diseases, and that same year the Indians had enough and they attacked and killed a third more of the settlers. Suffice it to say that by 1609 of April, a fellow by the name of Gates, the word had gotten back to England that these people had literally just, they were starving to death. A man by the name of Gates was dispatched to solve the problem. Gates and his men were shipwrecked in Bermuda for 9 months. They called it pleasantly detained. When Gates arrives at the Jamestown colony, he finds 60 survivors of all that have been there. And first thing Gates does when he gets off the boat is to get on his knees and thank God for safe passage, and then orders everybody to church and has his chaplain preach to them. He makes it mandatory. Matter of fact, it is a hanging offense not to go to church twice a week. Wouldn't that be wonderful, Brother Thorne? A hanging offense not to go to church twice in the week. But again, as I said before, I'm not trying to write these fellows off as completely different than those that preceded them. They weren't. They were gold, money-hungry thugs. And proof of that can be seen by the fact that in 1622, after the colony finally began to grow, there were 10 plantations operating in the Virginia colony with 1,200 settlers, and in 1,200 settlers, they had finally brought 3 preachers to this country. They had no intention of winning anybody to God. And so that first colony at Jamestown doesn't fly. All it did was incite the Indians to a frenzy, because they were the ones that were the brunt of the white man's atrocities. It is not until 1620 that a group of individuals that we'll look at next week land in Plymouth Colony on what is to be miraculously the only place along the coast of North America where white men could have landed and not instantly been attacked by Indians. The Pilgrims landed at Plymouth, which was unowned Indian territory. I'll tell you why next week. All right, take a break.